and that I've set up an impossibility for 3 days. And I'd like to give two hints, perhaps, to overcome that. One is that if you are next on the program and you have materials that will be utilizing this equipment, please bring it down to Wendy here, and she will set it up so that we can be ready and not take up too much setup time. And otherwise, of course, I trust that everyone will keep within the time frame so I don't have to awkwardly slip notes onto the podium. Our next speaker is Arthur Fierro, who's a graduate of the Manus College of Music with graduate degrees in music theory. For some time, he was administrative assistant to Walter Toscanini, and he has served frequently as consultant on the Arturo Toscanini archives. Mr. Fierro will speak to us today about the Toscanini archives' musical considerations. Mr. Fierro, are you here?
Yeah. I wish to thank Mr. Richard Perry and the Association for Recorded Sound Collections for their kind invitation and for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you about Arturo Toscanini. My special thanks to Tom Owen, who has been very kind, helpful, and patient. My purpose here today is to briefly discuss certain music and historic matters relating to Arturo Toscanini and the so-called Toscanini Riverdale Project Archive. It is no secret that Toscanini, among a number of today's music writers, has fallen into disfavor. His so-called objective literalist approach to music, which supposedly influenced generations of musicians and indeed to have created a modern school of conducting, is being rejected for a more subjective, a romantic approach to music. This subjective approach is best exemplified by Wilhelm Furtwängler. The rhetoric against Toscanini has intensified, and even gone so far as to attack him personally, as well as to question his artistic competence. However, the true facts do not support the rhetoric. Tom Owen correctly observed that Toscanini suffered from overexposure. Be that as it may, Toscanini was not himself responsible for this overexposure. He never sought publicity. He was simply a great artist and a truly humble man. Criticisms characterized by phrases such as streamlined rendering, a style very little dependent on literary culture and historic knowledge, and the assertion that his whole accent is on a structure of a piece are but three of the most common remarks made, in one form or another, about Toscanini's conducting style. These three quotations are from Virgil Thompson's 1942 article in the Herald Tribune entitled "The Toscanini Case." This article and others concerning Toscanini appear in reprints of Thompson's critical works and obviously remain a primary source, however prejudiced and inaccurate though they may be musically and historically, for today's generation of critics. Curiously, Thompson makes the same accusation against Furtwängler. He plays surefire stuff, writes Thompson, and streamlines a la Toscanini. In the February 1986 issue of The Atlantic, William H. Youngren, in a very fine article entitled "The Toscanini Sound," speaks to these misconceptions when he writes, "For every music writer who has actually studied the surviving Toscanini recordings with some care, there are at least 10 who are ready to assert, at a drop of a deadline, that Toscanini was, especially in his later years, a rigid and driven conductor who took everything too fast, paid little attention to expressive nuance, and sacrificed the music to his crusader's desire to play the notes exactly as the composer wrote them, with nothing added or subtracted. That this view of Toscanini is not based on his work should be immediately apparent to anyone who listens with an open mind." I fully concur with Mr. Youngren's analysis. But the rhetoric is not limited, unfortunately, to music writers. Daniel Barenboim, the pianist conductor and a Furtwängler disciple, is quoted in Philip Hart's book on conductors a new generation as saying, "If Toscanini had grown up in Berlin or Vienna, you know, he would not have been the same. Furtwängler grew up in the Mecca of Western orchestral music, Berlin, Munich, Leipzig, Vienna, where everything he heard and did was related to that tradition. He heard Wagner opera where they had been first performed, done by people who remembered that. But Toscanini started out in Parma, an absolutely uncultured, backward musical territory. When he fought for rhythm and intonation, he was working in an atmosphere where people, if there was a nice high note, would sit on it for a while. So when he fought for the actual interpretation of music, he fought for fidelity to the score. This statement is absurd. What Barenboim is saying, in effect, is that because Toscanini was an Italian-trained musician, he was artistically and intellectually incapable of comprehending German tradition in the music of Wagner or the great orchestral works of the Austrian-German composers. And to that I say nonsense. Yet in reality, this notion prevails today. I would suggest that Barenboim carefully reread Wagner's essay on conducting, which was specifically addressed to the Kapellmeisters of Germany. In that essay, Wagner describes at length the sorry state of performance practice among the Kapellmeisters, and states clearly that with respect to preserving German traditions of performance, quote, German culture has missed all such opportunities, unquote. This essay was dated in 1869, just 2 years after Toscanini's birth. It is also to Wagner's credit that his observations concerning the correct performance of German music transcends considerations of national boundaries and place of birth. His kinship with Liszt is a perfect example. He was not the architect of the notion that German art can only be served properly by German musicians. This concept is more a product of the post-German school of German nationalism, which in its most distorted form blossomed after World War I. That is still alive and well today is a tribute to the Kapellmeister mentality which Wagner so resented. Moreover, I would remind Barenboim that many great composers, artists, musicians, and scholars have been born and raised in humble surroundings in small towns and cities which do not qualify as meccas of culture. I would also remind him that there are many unfortunate examples of great artists of all kinds who died in poverty, unrecognized, in cities claiming to be the meccas of culture. But Parma, under no circumstances, can be described as an absolutely uncultured, backward musical territory. This is a totally false and absurd statement. Someday, read the article under Parma in the New Groves Dictionary of Music. You will discover that Parma was a city of royalty with a rich cultural life going back to the 15th century. In each century, the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th century, Parma made continuous and major contributions to music theory, instrumental, and vocal music. From 15th century theorists, including Johannes Lecrenzi and the renowned Nicholas Brucius, to noted Italian foreign musicians of the 16th century, including the great Flemish master Cipriano de Rora and Claudio Merulo, both buried in Parma's cathedral, to the 17th century when the great Teatro Farnese was built by the Farnese family, at which operas by important composers were performed, Parma was an important center for the arts. In 18th century Parma, the most important composer, Tommaso Tretta, and the poet Carlo Frugoni attempted reform of opera, which reconciled French taste and Neapolitan spectacle. And according to Groves, arts and letters flourished to such an extent that Parma became known as the Athens of Italy. In 1771, the illustrious composer Ferdinando Pair was born and trained in Parma. He was a contemporary of Beethoven, who spent most of his career in Dresden, Vienna, and Paris. In the 19th century, under Maria Luisa of Austria, Napoleon's second wife, who moved to Parma in 1815, a conservatory was founded, which Toscanini was later to attend. A court orchestra in 1816 was established and conducted by Paganini from 1835 to 1840. And the Teatro Ducale, later renamed the Teatro Reggio, was built in 1829. This opera house is one of the best in Italy, especially during the 19th century. As cellist, Toscanini played in its orchestra from the age of 13 to 18. The conservatory is one of Italy's finest and has an exceptional library. We know from Verdi himself that Parma Conservatory had a fine orchestra. Giusto Dacci, the noted Italian pedagogue and composer, headed the conservatory at the time that Toscanini was a student. He was Toscanini's composition teacher. Dacci was followed by a number of important Italian musicians and scholars, including Franco Faccio, the conductor under whose baton Toscanini was to play as cellist in the La Scala Orchestra at the world premiere of Verdi's Otello, and Arrigo Boito, Verdi's Shakespeare librettist and composer of Mephistopheles and Nerone. It was Boito who made it possible for Toscanini to become artistic head of La Scala in 1898 at the age of 31. Another native of Parma is the 20th century composer Ildebrando Pizzetti. And as for important conductors, Parma, in addition to Toscanini, produced Manlio, Gaetano Bavaglioni, Giovanni Bolzoni, Cleofonte Campanini, and Giuseppe Del Campo. Not such a bad track record for an absolutely uncultured, backward musical territory. The high standards Toscanini carried with him throughout his artistic life were learned in the Parma Conservatory. His musical education was extraordinary by any standard. He spent 9 years at the conservatory, entering at the age of 9 and a half. Shortly thereafter, he became a resident and full tuition scholarship student. The conservatory became his home. Life was not easy, but Toscanini enjoyed the challenge. There were 8 hours of classes a day of music and other subjects, 6 days a week. His progress was extraordinary, and by 13 years of age, he had acquired an exceptional mastery of the cello, which permitted him to play in the orchestra of the Teatro Reggio, as well as in other orchestras. He graduated at 18 in 1885 with highest honors in cello and composition, and received the Barbicini Prize as outstanding graduate. The proctor of the conservatory, from his perspective, recalled many years later that Toscanini was the most quiet student, very reserved, not very fond of amusements. He loved his art as an ardent lover. Very often he refused to go on the biweekly walk through the town and begged me to close him up in his little room where he would play and study for hours. This passionate devotion to the art of music remained undiminished until failing eyesight in the last months of his life no longer made it possible for him to study scores. Yes, even after his retirement, he continued to study scores. Obviously, there were other factors not taken into consideration by Barenboim. Toscanini was born in 1867, fully one generation before Furtwängler, who was born in 1886, the very same year that Toscanini made his historic debut in Rio de Janeiro, conducting a total of 11 operas from memory. It was on the 30th, the opera was Verdi's Aida, and this year is the 100th anniversary of that historic occasion. In 1899, when Furtwängler was 13 years old, Toscanini was in Bayreuth, attending performances conducted by Hans Richter, Siegfried Wagner, and others. He had already conducted his first season as artistic director of La Scala. In 1901, just 2 years later, when Furtwängler was 15 years old, Siegfried Wagner, the composer's son, himself a composer, attended on the 12th of January a performance of Tristan, conducted by Toscanini at La Scala. Toscanini was 34 years old. Let me quote Harvey Sachs' excellent biography on Toscanini. Siegfried was astounded by the level of excellence. He did not hesitate to express his admiration to Toscanini. When Siegfried told his mother about the Scala Tristan, she sent a grateful letter the 18th of January to the conductor. Briefly, I quote Cosima Wagner's letter. My son stressed the meticulous zeal with which you brought to the orchestral preparations and the excellent result obtained by this zeal, along with your ability as conductor. Siegfried's respect for Toscanini began with that Tristan performance in 1901. Against great opposition from conductor Karl Muck and others, Siegfried finally invited Toscanini to conduct at Bayreuth in 1930, the first non-German to do so. Toscanini's great dream was realized. Siegfried's sisters and stepsisters joined in expressing their unreserved admiration for Maestro when they finally heard him at Bayreuth. Samuel Chotzenoff, in his book, An Intimate Portrait, speaks of Daniela Thoda from personal experience. She was, of course, Wagner's stepdaughter. Her father was Hans von Bülow, and her grandfather was Franz Liszt. Chotanov writes, "Ever since she had met the maestro at Bayreuth, she had adored him as the greatest interpreter of Wagner's music she had ever heard." Unquote. How can anyone, including Barenboim, so completely ignore the well-documented esteem Siegfried and his sisters had for Toscanini as an interpreter, indeed one of the greatest interpreters of Wagner's music, and I might also add, as a human being? Friedland Wagner, Siegfried's daughter, and Toscanini's beloved Figliola, his young daughter, once wrote, "I have yet to meet a great artist whose character is as wonderful as his artistry, except when his name is Toscanini." Toscanini was a superb musical scholar, devoted not only to the study in microscopic detail of every aspect of the printed score, but pursuing the study of any and all documentation written by or about composers and the historical and cultural context in which they lived and worked. Whenever possible, he attempted to gain access to original manuscripts or facsimile editions. For these reasons, the microfilm collection of composer manuscripts here at Lincoln Center was dedicated as the Toscanini Memorial Archives in 1960. But music was not Toscanini's only lifelong passion. Painting and literature, poetry and history and philosophy, written in or translated into Italian, French, German, and English, were pursued with equal vigor. Samuel Chotanov tried to recall this aspect of Toscanini's intellect in a lecture he gave in 1962 for the American Italy Society. "He could recite endlessly," says Chotanov, "from Dante, Shakespeare, Leopardi, Swinburne, Rossetti, Poe, Emerson, Whitman, Longfellow, and Irving. He knew the works of Sainte-Beuve, Montaigne, Hazlitt, Thane, and Belinsky." Belinsky, Chotanov notes, a Russian literary critic in the early 1800s, is now hardly a name, even to Russians. But somehow, Toscanini knew what he had written about Russian literature of that time. And his respect, and with respect to music, I would like to add one other point. Toscanini's knowledge of pre-Baroque music was something extraordinary. But despite books by Chotanov, Taubman, and Sachs, Harold Schoenberg, in his recent 1985 book entitled The Glorious Ones, states emphatically that Toscanini was no intellectual. He relied on his technique, his musical instinct, and the printed note. As we have seen, Toscanini was, in fact, an extraordinarily cultured man and a superb musical scholar. And as the record also clearly indicates, he was a very great interpreter of the music of Richard Wagner. There are those who grudgingly admit that his Wagner was great, but when it comes to the symphonies of Beethoven, a line is drawn. Here we are no longer in the realm of opera, but in the world of absolute music. How furious Wagner would have been by such a distinction. But that is a subject for another paper. Toscanini's approach to music was expressed in a letter he wrote on August 5, 1931, to Baron Hans Paul von Wolzogen, a Wagner disciple who, according to Harvey Sachs, sent Toscanini an extremely laudatory letter concerning his performance of Parsifal. I quote Toscanini, "No words of praise could be dearer and more desirable than yours. If my interpretation has been able to reawaken in you an echo of that memorable one of 1882, it is the most I could aspire to in the fulfillment of my ideal dream, that is, to come as close as possible to expressing the composer's intention." For Toscanini, it was never just the notes on the printed page. However, the score was for him the primary source for understanding and expressing the composer's intentions, not his own, but the composer's. When he succeeded in achieving this ideal dream, the result was overwhelming and incomparable. Toscanini was not a literalist, nor did he establish any new school of conducting. He was a unique and great recreative artist who is without any doubt the single most important link we have to 19th century performance practice at its best. Indeed, the so-called objective approach to music must have been the norm for centuries. With the rise of virtuoso conductor in the 19th century, Then and only then did it become possible for a musical performance to be shaped in a subjective romantic manner. Toscanini did raise standards and demanded artistic integrity, and that contribution alone is significant. His repertory was international, his respect and knowledge of style exceptional, and in this sense, he was a modern conductor. And I might add that Toscanini was the great contrapuntalist among conductors. For him, every line was a melody. Everybody must sing, even the trombone, everybody singing. To sing every note, every part is a melody. Every instrument of the orchestra must not merely play the notes, but they must sing. These are quotations from Toscanini rehearsals. I am not here to convince you that Toscanini performances of this or that composer are without peer. It is, in the final analysis, a question of personal taste. However, I hope that I have clarified for you some historic inaccuracies. Greater insight into this man's extraordinary life and career will surface once the Riverdale Project archives, stored here at Lincoln Center for the past 16 years, are open. My association with Walter Toscanini began in 1963. He accepted my invitation to appear at a student council-sponsored lecture series at the Manus College of Music. Subsequently, through a series of events, I began to work for him as his administrative assistant, part-time, later full-time, until his death in 1971. Those years at the Toscanini Riverdale home were unique. A state-of-the-art sound studio had been installed in the basement billiard room in 1949, with many additions and modifications made into the 1960s in order to keep abreast of current technology. It was through this equipment that Toscanini listened to his recorded performances, and it was from this studio that master tapes, for the most part, were processed for release on commercial discs by RCA Records. John H. Corbett and Richard Gardner were the primary engineers working on these recordings during Maestro's lifetime. Corbett, the brilliant and dedicated engineer and technical curator of the sound archives, continued to work after Toscanini's death on the transfer, editing, and restoration of Maestro's recording until 1966, when Walter's financial difficulties necessitated his return to NBC. It was from the Riverdale Project master tapes that John Corbett personally prepared the tapes for the historic 100 LP album released in Japan in the mid-1960s, arrangements for which were made by the late Dario Soria, then vice president of RCA's Records International Division. However, those last years were not happy ones for the late Walter Toscanini. Walter desperately wanted to find a permanent home for the Toscanini archives by no later than 1967, the centennial of his father's birth. In my opinion, stress over pressing financial problems and frustration over his inability to gain support for the disposition of the archives contributed to a massive stroke he suffered in 1968. It left him partially paralyzed and aphasic until his death 3 years later at the age of 73. That tragic turn of events so exacerbated his financial difficulties that in 1970 he was forced to sell his beloved Villa Pauline, which has been since demolished. Thanks to Thor Wood and David Hall, the so-called Riverdale Project Archives was stored here at Lincoln Center through special arrangements where it still remains inaccessible in more than 700 crates, boxes, and file cabinets. This year, however, this past year, the archive was inventoried, revealing for the first time, even to surviving family members, the extraordinary scope of the collection which Walter Toscanini assembled at great personal sacrifice. And I might add that contributions of memorabilia and recordings from various friends and associates added substantially to the collection. From thousands of newspaper clippings, photographs, letters, programs, and posters, to hundreds of scores, many annotated by Toscanini, and some of which are dedicated to him and also contain annotations by composers, to a collection of rare scores, including first editions of the Beethoven symphonies and some Mozart operas, to his surviving library of books, to a large collection of non-Toscanini recordings, approximately 800 tapes, 250 lacquers, 1,800 commercial 78 RPM albums, 1,600 commercial and private edition LPs of operas and symphonies, and finally to a very large collection of his own performances, which on tape numbers approximately 3,700 reels of rehearsals and performances, and 1,600 reels of radio station materials, and on disc, approximately 2,578 RPM test pressings, 500 LP test pressings, 3,616-inch lacquers of concerts and rehearsals, 1,116-inch lacquers of opera broadcasts and rehearsals, 812-inch lacquers of concerts and rehearsals, 1,500 commercial 78, 45, and 33 RPM records, and other miscellaneous recordings, including TV films and the original Selenophone film recordings made in Salzburg in 1937. The Toscanini-Riverdale Project Archive is vast and unique. It is one of the great musical treasures of this century. So very rare is there available in any historic collection such a comprehensive overview of an artist's life and his times. That its scope creates staffing and space requirements is self-evident. That these requirements may necessitate the disposal of significant sections of this collection is for me very difficult to comprehend. In so doing, the historic record will be further distorted, and the ambience in which Maestro worked will be lost. In addition, the surviving material will be separated into two divisions, thus destroying the unity of the collection. It has been nearly 20 years since any work has been done on the tapes and discs, and that is a very long time. But it is my hope that the age of digital technology, still in its infancy, will make it possible to achieve better results in removing certain limitations inherent in these recordings. There was always great beauty of tone in Maestro's performances, which is not readily apparent in a number of his recordings. This was supposedly the result of the notorious acoustics of NBC's Studio 8H, from which Toscanini concerts were broadcast until the spring of 1950. Granted, there were limitations, but the problem had more to do with notorious microphone misplacement. Even some Carnegie Hall performances in the 1950 could sound like Studio 8H because of microphone misplacement. Listen someday to the 1952 performance of Gluck's Orfeo, Act Two. It sounds like Studio 8H. This archive also contains the rare Selenophone recording equipment and the original nitrate-based Selenophone sound films of Toscanini and Bruno Walter opera performances from the 1937 Salzburg Festival. The Magic Flute and the Meistersinger are the only recorded performances of these operas by Toscanini. The sound is not good. The problems are formidable. But at all costs, the Meistersinger especially must be restored. Wagner's daughters, Daniela Thode and Ava Chamberlain, were at these Salzburg performances. And according to published accounts, they were so overwhelmed that they were trembling. Toscanini was a supreme idealist whose legacy must survive in an age of cynicism. As an artist, Toscanini set an uncompromising standard in his performances, and in so doing brought great beauty into the world of music. Indeed, Toscanini's name has become synonymous with the concept of excellence and integrity. From my point of view, this same standard must be applied to the preservation of the Toscanini Riverdale Project collection. He served this country well as an artist and as an uncompromising enemy of fascism and Nazism. Already in his mid-70s, Toscanini did a great deal. He allowed the prestige of his name to be used. He conducted war bond concerts, made a film for the Office of War Information, wrote an open letter published in Life magazine, and much more. Yet this country has never honored him as an artist or as a great humanitarian. If he were alive today, he would steadfastly refuse such honors. Such was his humility. However, we can honor him by simply preserving intact this great archive, his legacy to future generations. The vital work of preservation, restoration, and educational use initiated by Walter Toscanini and his Riverdale Project must continue. I call upon all institutions which Toscanini served so well, here and abroad, and ask them to join together with music lovers, businessmen, and people of influence in and out of government, including this association, to do all that is necessary to achieve these vital objectives. For 68 years, Toscanini conducted, and the city of New York was the single greatest beneficiary of Toscanini's art, even more so than Milan, in fact, more than double. He gave nearly half of his artistic life to this city, the Metropolitan Opera, the New York Philharmonic, and thanks to the foresight and vision of the late General David Sarnoff, the NBC. New York has not been kind to the memory of Arturo Toscanini. Thank you very much.